everybody, and welcome back to New Books in History. I'm Marshall Poe, your host. Each week we pick a new history book that we find particularly interesting, and we interview the author of that book. This week we're very pleased to have Julian Zelizer on the show, and we'll be talking about his new book, Arsenal of Democracy, The Politics of National Security from World War II to the War on Terrorism. We'll also be talking to Julian about his activity as a public intellectual. This is the third, I believe, in a series of podcasts that we're doing in conjunction with the National History Center, and they suggested that we talk to Julian specifically about both this book and his work as a public intellectual. The National History Center is devoted to helping historians have their voices heard in public, and Julian certainly has a voice, and he will tell us a little bit about how he expresses it and gets people to listen. I hope that you enjoy the interview. Here it is. Hi, Julian.
Hi, Marshall.
How are you today?
Doing pretty well.
Good. I'm glad to hear it. Are you in you're in Princeton, New Jersey? Is that correct?
Yes, I'm in my office in Dickinson Hall.
Dickinson Hall. You know, I spent some time at Princeton University, actually. Not that many years ago, but I remember it's a very quiet place and good to study. That was my recollection of it. Quiet and good to study. I should tell our listeners that we have Julian Zelizer on the show today, and we will be talking about two things. One, we'll be talking about his terrific new book, Arsenal of Democracy, The Politics of National Security from World War II to the War on Terrorism. And I can tell you, I found this book incredibly eye-opening, almost on every page. You know, it's one of these books where you think you understand why X happened, but there's always a really long and complicated backstory full of contingency. And Julian does a terrific job of ferreting out all of those complexities. I don't think I'll ever read the New York Times the same way again, because they inevitably get it wrong. You'll pardon me for saying. And Julian gets it right on every page. So I really encourage you to read the book. And the other thing we're going to be talking about is Julian's activities as a public intellectual. One of the purposes of this show is to help people understand what historians do. And part of what historians do is attempt to not only inform the public at large, but also to shape or inform policy decisions. And Julian is one of the premier, I guess I would call them, historian public intellectuals in the United States. And he knows the ropes. He knows how this game is played. And I don't mean game in a trivial sense. And so we'll be talking to him about his various activities, talking to members of Congress and the press and writing op-eds and these kinds of things. And we'll ask him about the way in which historical thinking and research can inform the policy debates. But before we get to that, Julian, why don't you just tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure thing. I'm from New Jersey. I grew up in Metuchen, New Jersey, and I went to Brandeis University as an undergraduate. That's where I became interested in political history. I worked with Professor Jim Kloppenberg, who studies the history of political ideas, and I did a junior project with him funded by the Ford Foundation on the history of liberalism in Massachusetts, which turned into my senior thesis. And that's when I really became quite interested in pursuing this profession. I then went to Johns Hopkins University, where I worked with Lou Galambos, my advisor, who focuses on 20th century institutions. And I wrote my dissertation on Wilbur Mills, who was the chairman of the House.
Wilbur Mills. Yeah.
Yes.
That's not a name I've heard in a while.
Incredibly powerful politician who went down in one of the big scandals in American politics. And that turned into my first book. And I really wanted to kind of get into the heart of Washington. And he was a perfect figure to try to understand how the institutions worked. And more importantly, I was really interested in Congress and what role Congress played in shaping legislation. And my first job was at SUNY Albany, where I was in the history department and the public policy school, and I spent several years there. Finished the Mills book, wrote a bunch of articles, and started a second book on congressional reform in the 1970s, how younger liberals tried to fix the institution, ranging from filibuster reform to opening up committee hearings to the public, and what happened to the reforms. And it's a story in part on how conservatives took advantage of many of the reforms that liberals had put into place during the 1980s and 90s. I then moved to Boston University, where I was in the history department, and I worked closely with Bruce Shulman to develop a bunch of programs on political history. And most recently, I came here to Princeton, where I finished this book, Arsenal of Democracy. And I've really been interested, I mean, the specifics of Congress, America since World War II, but more broadly, I've been really engaged and have attempted to revitalize the field of American political history, which for many decades had been a bit moribund.
No, that is absolutely true, what you say about that. It's a little bit, I do some military history, and I think that the same is true of military history, although I think that it's coming back in some way. Why don't you tell us how you, by the way, I wanted to say that Metuchen, New Jersey, I know Metuchen, New Jersey a little bit because I had a girlfriend in college from there. That's where yes, that's the only reason. Metuchen, it's right down the road from Princeton, isn't it?
Yeah, it's about a half hour.
Yeah, right. It's on the train there. The so, Martha, if you're listening, why don't you tell us how you came to write this particular book, Arsenal of Democracy?
This started really, I was finishing this book on congressional reform right around 9/11, and like all Americans who lived through 9/11, it was, you know, highly traumatic event, and it got me thinking about national security, but the continued partisanship that followed about 2 days of politicians saying everyone would be united, and that broke down very quickly. I just started watching the news on kind of how the politics was playing out in the response to this issue, and that just got me interested to look back at how the nation and how political leaders have handled other national security crises. And first, the book was going to be about America since Vietnam and kind of how Vietnam had impacted the politics of national security. But as always, with historians, I moved back in time and really ended up starting the heart of the book in World War II and the early Cold War with the creation of a national security state. And you know, there is this kind of conventional argument that politics stops at the water's edge. And I think many people know that's not true. And they have a sense that's just the same. But what's remarkable is we don't really have histories of that, of how it's played out in the political world and how the parties have struggled on this issue and some of the political pressures policymakers face when dealing with everything, including moments I have in the book like the Cuban Missile Crisis, that we forget about the politics. And I really wanted to write a kind of big narrative synthesis of how this issue has played out. And that was really the origins of the book. And then it was it's one of those topics where since not a lot has been written on it, you as the historian just find a surprise in every archive. And it's a kind of very engaging topic to write about that way.
No, I think you're absolutely right about our inability to almost see past this cliche, politics stops at the water's edge. I know that in some research that I was doing recently on World War I and World War II and America's entry into both of those wars, there was pretty serious debate about whether we should enter first World War I, obviously, and then even World War II. This is a war that we think of as the good war, and of course we were going to get into it, and of course we were going to fight the Nazis. They were evil incarnate. But in fact, when you go and look at the documents, I didn't look at a lot of them, but there were a lot of people who were playing politics with that issue. And again, I don't mean playing in the trivial sense that these things aren't as clear cut. And this is even more shocking to me because we know that recently in the decision to go to war in the Second Gulf War, there was a lot of debate about it. I mean, our own recent experience tells us this.
Yeah, I think, my sense is there's kind of three reasons about why you didn't have a book like this. One is it's a myth and it's a cliche, but it is one to some degree we want to be true. I don't think people look favorably at how political national security is in recent years. So you kind of hope that, moment when Arthur Vandenberg and Harry Truman were able to work together for a year represented, what we could do. And so I think that's part of it. There's a kind of historiographical issue, diplomatic history, kind of it became isolated like political history did after the 1960s and the social and cultural history revolution. And the thing was, diplomatic and political history remain separate. Diplomatic history turned much more toward the study of State Department officials, mm-hmm. of international negotiations, and they didn't look at the kind of sources which would bring it back to the politics of the issue.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, political history didn't really deal with national security foreign policy. They
yeah.
were, as they rebuilt the field, they were really focused on, including myself, on domestic issues, social security, welfare.
Mm-hmm.
And so these two fields have remained far apart. And the third is, you know, it required a lot of the archives used usually to study issues of war and peace are, again, you know, State Department documents
mm-hmm.
or advisors to the president who focus exclusively on policymakers. And what you have to look at is everything from the newspapers of the period to oral histories of the period to, you know, the political operatives and what they were saying to really get a flavor of this other, to congressional hearings, of this other side of the story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know that when I was in, actually this takes me back to my time in Princeton, I was at the Institute for Advanced Study, and Jack Matlock was there, who was the last American ambassador to the Soviet Union when there was a Soviet Union, and I used to eat lunch with him occasionally. And it was very eye-opening when he was discussing exactly what they were doing, because he always put everything in a political context. I mean, he said something that I've never forgotten, and actually I repeat quite a bit, and that is that you can't ask a politician to do something he can't do. If you see
right.
what I mean. And that, you know, right. I'd never really realized that before, but you're right, you can't. And especially in the American context, you can't ask a politician to do what he can't do. So,
right.
yeah, no, I think that's right. And I learned that from Matlock, who was a, you know, sort of both a consummate diplomat and politician. And actually, I should say George Kennan was right down the hall from us at uh-huh. the Institute. So he was very old at that point. But nonetheless, I had
yeah.
met him earlier in my life and also a consummate politician, public intellectual, and diplomat. So one of the things I was very interested about in your book was this notion of a national security state. Maybe you could talk a little bit about that.
Sure. I mean, America, you know, one of the other myths is that America wasn't really involved in international affairs and war before the 1930s. And in fact, you know, there's great historians such as George Herring who have now demolished that myth that we were isolationist until World War One and World War Two, and they've shown all sorts of wars and military operations we were involved with from the founding of the country through the current period. That the thing is, we didn't have a permanent national security apparatus the way we have since the Cold War, meaning institutions like the CIA and the National Security Council, a really robust and sizable Navy, Army, an Air Force. We didn't have a permanent draft. It was fought until the 1930s and 40s on a much more ad hoc basis. We went to war, we engaged in a military operation, and we took things apart. We didn't spend very much relative to other countries on these kind of operations. And all that changed. It starts, I think, I mean, World War One begins it, but a lot of the state is dismantled after that war. But with World War II and the Cold War, we take a series of steps and put institutions into place that are not retrenched, and they will remain part of our political system until today. And again, you know, the CIA is just—it's kind of a great model, and there's all kinds of policies and ideas and commitments that were meshed into the fabric of our democracy.
Mm-hmm. No, I tell you.
I mean, the questions that then raised, you know, after you have this Cold War national security state put into place, I talk in the book that there is always this tension between the arsenal and democracy.
Mm-hmm.
For our democracy, the question was, would these institutions, what have been called sometimes the military-industrial complex, would they take on a life of their own? Would policymakers be able to make decisions outside of the political process and take us to war when they wanted and engage us in certain areas when they wanted. And for policymakers, the challenge was, how do you formulate policy when, as you said, politicians are thinking about elections all the
yeah,
time?
That's right.
And that's very much on their mind. And so this created tensions that I think have played out in the last six decades and have been at the heart of our political debate.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting you mention the growth of the national security bureaucracy. I tell my students when they come to my office and ask me about careers, I tell them to get in on the ground floor of the Department of Homeland Security, because I don't think it's going to do anything but grow. That would be my impression. There was a time, though, of course, when we didn't have any of these things. And I do wonder if there's not a certain slippery slope here, that We started off in a direction, and you don't need to be a Republican or a kind of small statist, so to say, to see this, that, you know, to me, as someone who's a European historian, when the Department of Homeland Security was created, I really thought it was jaw-dropping because, you know, it really brings to mind continental European analogs, you know, the in the German context, the Sicherheitsdienst, which, you know, is the, you know, it's basically the Gestapo. So I do wonder what you might say about how we got from the point where we basically didn't have a standing army to the point where we could have a Department of Homeland Security.
Well, part of it was just the impact of crisis. So, you know, one of the first big changes is the implementation of a permanent draft. And we do that during World War II in 1940, right before the end of the war. Until that time, creating a draft in this country was as volatile as, in some ways, you know, Homeland Security programs have been. Many conservatives said this was a bad idea. You have a standing army here. Many liberals felt the same way, that they argued that the government would have the power to coerce people into going to war. Unions, for example, in the 40s were very nervous that they'd be drafted if they caused problems. They'd just start drafting workers to end strikes. Hmm. So it was really controversial. The crisis of World War II really pushed FDR and Democrats and some Republicans to accept it. So part of the same thing happened with the Cold War, and I'd argue the same thing happened after 9/11. A part of it is that kind of the opposition in general did fade. I mean, it was very strong still in the 40s, the fears and anxieties about a national security state. There were Republicans like Robert Taft of Ohio who were leaders in the party. They weren't marginal figures. Were really opposed to a lot of this, and they were kind of consistent in their opposition to big government, whether you're dealing with war or whether you're dealing with, you know, welfare. But they also become less important in the party during the 50s and 60s. They're replaced by people like William Buckley, who argue that on national security, conservatives had to basically accept a large national security state. It was distasteful. It was not good. But that's one area where government was necessary. It's been really an important part of conservatism, the national security aspect, not just the small government aspect. And then, you know, liberalism in the 1940s and 50s embraced the idea that also a national security state was essential. FDR, Truman, most of the congressional Democrats didn't have much in terms of negative things to say about what was going on. So you do have something of a consensus broadly over creating this state. And once you have a big institution, they're hard to dismantle. You're right, and we're seeing that today. Presidents can rarely remake the landscape that they inherit.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that's very interesting. So if World War II is the moment at which Americans and American politicians decided that we were going to embrace foreign entanglements, let's put it that way, one of the things that was very interesting to me in your book, and you talk a lot about, is the way in which, and this may be a mischaracterization, I may be reading something into what you've said, so I want you to carefully listen and respond. It seems to me that both the Republicans and the Democrats after Truman were involved in kind of the metaphor of an arms race comes to mind. That is, each was trying to demonstrate that the other was more hawkish. And in that sense, they pushed everyone to the, and I want to say right, but they pushed everyone to the side which said we needed a large security apparatus. I mean, one of the things I think people don't realize, and again, it's pretty clear in the documents, is that both Richard Nixon and JFK were very strong anti-communist candidates, that it doesn't break in the same way as it does today. Maybe you could talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, the late 40s and 50s for me were some of the most interesting times to write about. Part of what happens is obviously Democrats come out of World War II strong politically on the issue of national security. You know, FDR had led the nation through a kind of clear victory, decisive victory. But in the late 40s, some of the politics changes. Many Republicans are looking for ways to criticize the Democrats to regain what's now called the national security advantage. And two major events include the fall of China to communism in 1949, and then the stalemate in Korea between 50 and 53. And Republicans use both of those as a way to criticize Democrats for a kind of being weak on defense, same charges you hear today, for not doing enough to fight against communism. In addition to not doing enough here in the States, they argued, to root out communist spies. Mm-hmm. And the 52 election, where Adlai Stevenson loses to Eisenhower, Republicans gain control of Congress, two of the big issues, in addition to corruption, were anti-communism here at home in Korea. Mm-hmm. And for Democrats of that generation, people like Lyndon Johnson, I think that election scarred them, and those national security battles really got into their psychology. They weren't going to let that happen again. And in the 50s, the Democrats were the hawks. I mean, one of the things that happens mm-hmm. in the mid-50s is Democrats in the Senate start to attack Dwight Eisenhower. And they say that Dwight Eisenhower is so focused on balancing budgets and trying to cut military spending, which he was, and that he was endangering the country and that we weren't spending enough on missiles and other kinds of weapon systems. And this is a very kind of prevalent argument in the 50s by people like Stuart Simonton, a Missouri Democrat, or John F. Kennedy, or Henry Scoop Jackson of Washington. And there's hearings, and they're saying this in the media. And when Sputnik happens in 57, a story we all know, it wasn't just about a scientific race with the Soviet Union. Democrats, as soon as Sputnik happens, say, look, we were right. The Soviets are far ahead of us, because this president is so concerned about cutting spending, and we are in a dangerous position militarily. And so the missile gap debate, which is what Kennedy uses against Nixon, arguing Eisenhower had left the country with a gap in terms of missile production compared to the Soviets, it was how JFK positioned himself as a strong anti-communist, but equally important, it grew out of 1950s Democratic politics. Mm-hmm. And it will be very important to Johnson as he accelerates the war in Vietnam a few years later, that same kind of mentality, not to get out-hawked by the Republicans.
Out-hawked. That's exactly the phrase I was looking for. Because it's sort of an analogy to something a friend of mine used to tell me, teaches in an English department. He would say that during English department debates, people would out-left one another. I don't know. And here these people are out-hawking one another. That's exactly the phrase I want. I think the contemporary Republican Party would do well to actually look back to the Eisenhower era and think about those Eisenhower Republicans. They're gone now, as far as I can tell. So one of the things I wanted to kind of challenge you to do, and I think it would be interesting for the listeners, is, I mean, the brunt of the argument of your book is that politics matters a lot. That is, congressional politics and presidential politics, not only a kind of ideology and national interest and these sorts of things, for national security decisions. For decisions about whether to go to war and so on and so forth. And I wanted to just take you through a series of questions about why we went to war and see if you could give a sort of, I don't know if counterintuitive is the right word, but to give us the political context of the decision to take us to war. And we won't deal with World War I or World War II, but let's start with Korea because you have some fascinating things about that. We tend to look back at Korea and we say we're going to fight international communism and everybody got on board. And then we went to Korea and we saved the South Koreans. What actually happened?
Well, in that case, you have to start with the fall of China to communism, and that happens in 49, whereas the war with Korea starts in 1950. And the attacks that emerge after the events in China, with Republicans really intensifying their attacks on the Truman administration, and at the same time, kind of allies of Senator Joe McCarthy intensifying their attacks that we're not doing enough to root out communist spies in the State Department are very much on the minds of the Truman administration. Truman had tried to position himself as a strong anti-communist, both with the Truman Doctrine, the National Security Act, and more, but he's on the defensive in 1950 when the invasion in South Korea happens. Democrats are also very nervous about the 1950 midterm elections. Not that they will lose control of Congress, but that the conservative coalition of Southern Democrats and Republicans are going to expand their numbers. The context in which Truman makes decision is one where Democrats are feeling immensely defensive and nervous that if there is not a strong response to the invasion, that he will open himself up to charges of kind of falling down on the job again, doing essentially what had happened in his critics' mind with China. And importantly, it's not the reason he makes the decision. And I don't want to argue that politicians always go to war because of political decisions.
Sure.
But it is the context in which they have to make these decisions. And it is one of the pieces that influences them. And Truman himself, there's evidence, was very cognizant of this as he was trying to decide what to do.
Yeah. I'm smiling, which doesn't really help on the radio, but that was really quite brilliant. I think that was very eye-opening for me, that part of the book. Because
thank you.
I really did think that at that point that politics did stop at the water's edge. But as you make a point,
I must say, you know, after he goes in and then the midterm elections, you know, are basically gearing up as the Korean War starts. And those midterm elections of 1950, I mean, just a close look at them should shatter the notion that the early Cold War was some period where, you know, Arthur Vandenberg and Harry Truman were the norm. They are absolutely brutal. In a way, you know, they resemble the 2002 midterm elections, which were also very political. Republicans were aggressively attacking Democrats and saying, you know, the reason Korea is not going well is because Truman has refused to invest in the army. It's because he's not using enough force in Korea. He won't, you know, bomb. And that, you know, the worst kind of allegations. He's not taking anti-communism in the U.S. seriously, and it's a pretty brutal campaign. And conservative, the coalition increases its numbers in 1950. You know, there's one account that, you know, that Truman, after those midterm elections, gets a bit drunk because he's so depressed about the outcome, George Elsie, one of his advisors, recalls that. But those midterm elections, I think, also kind of that's the bookend to when that Korea decision was made.
Yeah, that's just fascinating. I love backstories. I love it when historians discover backstories. So let's move on to Vietnam and the Tonkin Gulf resolution, particularly, but also the escalation. Maybe you could talk a little bit about how politics played into that decision.
That's huge. I mean, there's different interpretations of why Johnson went into Vietnam. You know, some have stressed the more familiar story of the Cold War domino theory consensus. It was inevitable. That's how everyone was thinking at the time, and so Johnson just took what everyone was advising him to do. Another is Johnson's own machismo and manhood was at stake. That's another interpretation. The interpretation I found most compelling and came out of the document was the politics. Again, Johnson was a product of 1950s America. He was a product of all these wars, political wars that Democrats had gone over about whether they were weak on defense. And he becomes president after Democrats had, you know, rebuilt their reputation through this missile gap argument, through Kennedy's performance in the Cuban Missile Crisis. And he's very nervous, Johnson, in 64, that, you know, this can go away, and the Democrats can easily be attacked as weak on defense. And what's amazing is so many advisors were telling Johnson in 64, don't go into Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
People like Richard Russell, a conservative Georgian, who was Johnson's mentor, is saying on these tapes, the war isn't actually worth much strategically. It's not going to get us anywhere against communism, and we're never going to win it. Johnson's aware of this, but one of the things he keeps coming back to is the politics, that politically, if he is weak, if he withdraws, he's going to make Democrats vulnerable to Goldwater, who in the summer of 64 is raising this as a key issue of Vietnam and Johnson's defense credentials, and obviously with Congress. Johnson doesn't want to lose control because he has an ambitious domestic agenda. And Johnson also says, you know, Republicans would be much more dangerous on national security.
Mm-hmm.
So, in fact, it's important I win whatever way I can because Goldwater will get us into a nuclear war.
Yeah.
And the politics, both with the Gulf of Tonkin and then with the escalation that follows the election of 64, politics is front and center on his mind as he's trying to figure out what to do. One other thing is, you know, the way there's many questions about the Gulf of Tonkin resolution in the Senate, and recent work has shown it wasn't that all the senators except a couple agreed on this. There were many concerns about all the issues that would emerge later. You know, is this too, mm-hmm. giving away too much to the president? And what Johnson does is he has William Fulbright go and sell this to members of Congress, making two arguments. One is that if Johnson needs more authority to send, if Johnson wants to send troops, Fulbright says, he will return to Congress and ask for more authority. And he'd given him a personal assurance. And B, that Johnson needed this to cover himself in the election, and that politically Democrats couldn't afford to vote no on Gulf of Tonkin.
Mm-hmm.
And Fulbright would later write about this in his own book, saying it was one of the biggest mistakes he had made and that politics shaped how he handled this.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I want to go on to another event that we've talked about on this show before. We've had a couple of people, actually. We had Steve Kotkin on a couple of weeks ago talking about a related issue, and that is Reagan's meeting with Gorbachev at Reykjavik, where he decides, I want to use the word unilaterally, but that can't be right. He decides of his own free will that he will propose tremendous cuts in nuclear arms. What is the political backstory here?
Well, there you have a politician who makes one of the most dramatic changes that we see in the public eye, meaning, you know, Reagan had been a key member of the conservative movement. He had been a quintessential anti-communist warrior. You know, in the 70s, he had been one of the leading critics of détente. He challenged Gerald Ford in 1976, arguing that a fellow Republican was endangering the country by negotiating, as Nixon had did, with the Soviets over arms reductions, mm-hmm. and we couldn't trust the Soviets. And then he really, that was what he was known for. In his early years, he stood by that. Even though he was more open to negotiations than we thought, and you were showing that, he still, you know, was very cold about negotiations and didn't put, you know, anyone but neoconservatives in key positions to handle that issue and made very aggressive rhetoric in talking about the Soviet Union. But then when the opportunity emerges with Gorbachev, and between 85 and 87, he engages in a series of very big negotiations and moves to a place that he had been criticizing in the 1970s. Part of the politics is just Reagan as a presidential leader. He saw an opportunity, and he was more pragmatic than we remember, and he was willing to take this chance. Part of it is the negotiations accelerate as Iran-Contra has become a big issue in 86 mm-hmm. and 87 and is really harming his presidency. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's kind of scandal, which I think now we're starting to forget how big it was and the potential was. And this, in the end, rebuilds his presidency. And he kicked many hardliners out as a result of the Iran-Contra scandal mm-hmm. that left moderates in place. And finally, I mean, the other political backdrop is most conservatives were against this, and we forget that.
Yeah, no, they were. I remember
what as he's negotiating, conservative activists are comparing him to Neville Chamberlain.
Yep.
That one Howard Phillips calls him a fool of the Kremlin. And even prominent people like George Will and Dan Quayle, then a senator, are really against the INF Treaty, which is what is signed in 87 mm-hmm. and finally ratified. And Reagan has to kind of contain and calm conservatives for their argument. They were saying he had abandoned his principles. Mm-hmm. And it's a really kind of tough political battle for the administration.
Mm-hmm.
And in the end, conservatives are not happy. That's what we forget. They weren't happy in 88 with what he had done. But in time, they kind of rebuilt their memory of him and saying this was, in fact, his great moment.
Yeah, no, it's funny because it seems to me that element of the Reagan presidency in the conservative telling of the Reagan presidency is almost always forgotten. It's just as if they don't want to remember it, but they were livid. They were absolutely livid about it. Because he was taking the party in a direction that they didn't think it should go. So let's move on to more contemporary events and talk about the first Gulf War. What is the political backdrop of that?
Well, that's a big one. I mean, George H.W. Bush, believed that the Democrats and the country had moved in the wrong direction on national security after Vietnam, and that we were too hesitant to embrace the use of military force when necessary. when Iraq invades Kuwait, there's a lot of opposition to going into the war. Democrats are not in favor of this. They want to argue that we should allow international sanctions more time to work to pressure Hussein. And it becomes a very partisan issue early on. The parties are lined up against each other. And Bush makes a strong push that this is a case we need military force. When we go into the war, Democrats remain hesitant. In the end, they kind of say they support it because politically there was no other option. And when that war comes to a close, it's a really difficult political moment for Democrats because Bush had argued we need to overcome the Vietnam syndrome, and he was arguing he just did it, and the Democrats did against him. And there's a famous moment after where he goes and speaks to Congress, and the Republicans are wearing flags and reminding voters that they had been in favor of this and Democrats against it. And the administration is very cognizant of using this as a key issue going into the 92 election. So it's a highly partisan kind of war, and it's a very political, both when it's starting out, but also when it ends. In the end, you know, he can't make as much of it as he thought for that election. And one of the things that goes wrong is, you know, Bush had been steadfast in not going after Saddam Hussein. And one of the reasons he said was politically the nation wouldn't stand for it. Bush said, you know, we're getting over the Vietnam syndrome, but it's still a country that doesn't really like to go to war. And so he kind of limited the operation. And what happens is in 92, Hussein is back in the news, and he's, you know, attacking various factions, and he's taunting the Bush administration. And many Democrats say, look, he wasn't actually so good on defense. You see that battle to be a hawk emerge. Senator Gore writes a letter to the administration saying they haven't done enough in the post-war period to really contain Hussein.
Yeah. No, it's interesting in the perspective of history. I don't think we really know yet whether to call the halt before Baghdad a good move or a bad move or not. I know that immediately afterwards and actually in the following years that everyone castigated it and said that we should have gone on and taken Baghdad and gotten rid of Hussein. But in light of what happened after, maybe George Herbert Walker Bush was not such a dumb fellow. Anyway, one thing that I was quite amazed about, actually, I don't really know what to call them. Do they have a name? The Kosovo bombings, the Serbian bombings?
They don't have a tag.
Yeah, they don't have no tag for those. Yeah. But they were they were important and they were big.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the 90s chapter is about, in part, it's not unlike the 50s with Democrats trying to rebuild their political image on national security. And there's a number of steps that Clinton goes through where in fact, Democrats are being more aggressive in the use of military force and building national security institutions than Republicans. One is the Bosnia bombing in 1995. It will kind of culminate then with Kosovo in 99. In both cases, you know, the administration is pushing the use of military force, where many Republicans are saying these are not good operations and we have to withdraw a little bit from international affairs. A second area I talk about in my chapter in the 90s is Oklahoma City, mm-hmm. which was a really, you know, huge terrorist attack in 1995 on a federal government building. And following that, the administration pushes for a vast expansion of Homeland Security, pushing for measures like something called roving wiretaps, where the government could tap several phones that one person is using as they get rid of each phone without getting a new court order. And it's the Republicans who are opposing this. Mm-hmm. Bob Barr in the House leads a coalition that links up with civil libertarians and says this is too much government. And both of those, Bosnia, Kosovo, the strikes against Al-Qaeda, which are undertaken, and the Oklahoma City response, it's the Democrats that come by the late 1990s with a pretty aggressive kind of national security agenda, which, again, isn't unlike what happened in the 1950s, feeling a bit more hawkish as the decade ended than they had for a long time.
Mm-hmm. No, I remember being very surprised about what Clinton was doing. And you'll pardon me for saying admiring it, but in any event, actually, I heard Bill Clinton on the radio just the other day about this Haitian crisis, and that guy is good. The guy's really good. that guy can definitely talk a good game. Let's talk about 9/11 and the aftermath, and I'll just tell one anecdote. I remember I was was teaching at a university on the East Coast, and I had the opportunity every week to meet with about 25 of my peers every week on a administrative board. And I remember the morning of 9/11 very well, and I walked into the room. It must have even been the same day, or maybe it was a couple days later. I don't remember. But everybody had one of these flag lapel pins on.
Right.
Where did they get those things? You know, I think I was the only person in the room who didn't have one. Everybody was all of a sudden had a flag lapel pin on. Did politics stop at the water's edge after 9/11?
Not at all. That's when I started the book. There's a couple days tops when the politicians aren't fighting with each other. I think on September 12th, you know, Hillary Clinton makes a big speech saying we will be united behind the president. There's events in Washington where they stand together, and Republicans offer the same kind of thing. But within the first year, that ends. And as the U.S. tries to respond in terms of revamping Homeland Security, the political battles start instantly. One of the big battles early on is about airport security, mm-hmm. and Democrats actually are pushing more aggressively than Republicans to revamp airline security. But one of the things they want to do is, have the workers who are handling new initiatives be federalized and have union protection. Republicans are against this. And instantly the fight starts with Republicans saying that, you know, Democrats are holding up national security because of their, you know, being linked to unions. Mm-hmm. And Democrats making the same kind of arguments that the administration's playing politics right after 9/11 because mm-hmm. they want to kind of take it out on Democratic constituencies. And the politics is there right from the start. So sometimes we saw it in partisan battles over what to do. I also think in the build-up to Iraq and the resolution authorizing force, you saw politics as well in a different way. Many Democrats voted in favor of it, even though there were open debates about whether this was the right thing to do and whether this was a good use of force. It was a little like Vietnam. It wasn't that there was a consensus that Iraq was a good decision. The debates were right on the floor. You can just read them. Mm-hmm. And in the end, I think a lot of Democrats had those same fears that Johnson had of the Republican right, that if at that moment they voted against this resolution, they could destroy their party, mm-hmm. kind of being weak on defense post 9/11. And I think many of the senators who voted for it were part of a political competition in some ways that, you know, starts in the 90s as Democrats are trying to rebuild their hawkish credentials. Mm-hmm. And they get right into it again.
Mm-hmm. No, I remember this very well. I was working in Washington at the time, and I was working for a magazine, a political magazine, and I remember the debates. We had them in the office. And it's funny because if you read the political press now, especially the leftist or left political press, the story that they tell is George Bush and his neocons. It sounds like a new wave group or something, doesn't it? George Bush and his neocons.
Yeah.
George Bush and his neocons basically bamboozled us into going to war and kind of forced it down our throats, that he somehow engineered it all himself. And that was that's just not what happened at all. I mean, I remember it very well that and actually here's one moment where the national security state sort of did what it's supposed to do, because the different agencies said different things. I remember reading the State Department intelligence analysis, and it said something entirely different than the one that was out from the CIA or the National Intelligence. And I think it was the National Intelligence Estimate. Is that what it's called?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. And then I remember the State Department officials put footnotes in it saying, we don't agree. If I recall correctly, I don't remember. This is amazing. I mean, they're not even – the National Security Administration can't even – or National Security apparatus can't even speak with one voice about this. And then there was this – I mean, nobody agrees on what's going on
here. No, absolutely. And again, it's not – you don't have to look too hard. It's in the mainstream papers, the New York Times, Washington Post. They raise questions. The Post has a big story. It was on the front page, I believe, about whether the evidence about Hussein's weapons programs were sound. This was before the resolution has even passed. Senator John Kerry, initially is asking why the president wants to rush to war in Iraq because of all the mistakes that had been made in Afghanistan. And you have, Nancy Pelosi's openly questioning this. And I think, again, in the end, it wasn't Bush in a secret a cabal of neoconservatives just tricked the nation and we weren't paying attention. I think the party leaders had this debate, and in the end, I really do think in that case, the political atmosphere and the political competition, partisan competition, led many Democrats not to vote, based on what they knew or what they were saying.
Yeah, but I mean, I think the important thing to remember and have stick very firmly in our mind is that there was a very aggressive debate, and people were raising the questions about what would happen if we didn't find, for example, weapons of mass destruction, even at the time. I mean, I remember very clearly we were in the same office, this magazine, and one of my colleagues was Ross Douthat, who's a conservative columnist.
Right.
And he wasn't a conservative in columnist at the time. And I remember we were debating this and we were going over the evidence because one of my colleagues was writing a story about one of the fellows on the UN Weapons Inspection Committee, a guy named Scott, I don't remember his last name. In any event, he said there were no weapons of mass destruction. Yeah, Scott Ritter, exactly, who turns out to have been exactly right.
Right.
But who was painted as a lunatic. And anyway, and Douthat kind of stood up at our cubicle farm and said, well, what happens if they don't find them? What will we do if they don't find them? And we just all kind of looked at one another like, no way. There's no way that can happen. There's no way that can happen. And but we'd all read the evidence, and we knew they might not find them, and they didn't find them. So, it was really in hindsight, everything looks very, very different. So, and your book does a terrific job of bringing that out. I really think it does. Let's shift gears a little bit and talk a little bit about your efforts as a public intellectual, and particularly how you've used your own historical research to try to impact policy and thinking, and to inform the populace generally. What are the sort of basic techniques that you use? I hope everything's okay there. Is that on your end or mine?
I think it's on your end.
Oh, is it okay? I hope everything's okay. Yeah. Are we in code orange or what are we, horn yellow? I don't know where we are right now. So anyway, why don't you talk a little bit about that?
I started doing it speaking. I didn't go into it planning to do this. When I was a professor in SUNY Albany, I remember during the impeachment of Bill Clinton, the local CBS Morning News asked me if I had just come on and provide a little historical perspective on impeachment and how this compared to some other moments such as in the 19th century. And so I did it, and it was fun and interesting. You have 30 seconds to speak, but I didn't mind that. And I started to do more and more of it. And since the 1998, I've been doing a number of things. I appear in radio, or I interview with reporters, or I go on television to give, the soundbite analysis to the historian. And I also now, in the last 2 or 3 years, have been writing a lot of op-eds everywhere, New York Times, Post, Politico, CNN, and a bunch of places. And I really enjoy doing it. I mean, I think, it's a very different kind of format. I have to be very short, much punchier, and I really have to get to the bottom line of what I want to argue about, how history informs, Obama's decision to go into Afghanistan or accelerate the number of troops in Afghanistan, or whether it was about, Bill Clinton's impeachment. And they have to write in a, very legible prose. So anyone can understand it. But I enjoy it. I mean, one of the remarkable things is historians have some things to say, I think. Mm-hmm. My field obviously is well built for that. But I've been able to reach a lot of people by essentially providing a little historical perspective to some arguments that get out there at any given moment. I try not to be very partisan. I try not to be very polemic. That's, I think, how people usually read me. So I get attacked by the left and right, which I usually consider.
That's good. That's excellent.
That's my favorite when that happens. Yeah. And I just, I really am trying to do genuinely the historical context of whatever we're talking about or whatever the issue of the day is. Sometimes I do less of that. It's more standard opinion piece. But that's really what most interests me. And it's helped me with my own teaching and writing because the exercise of trying to really work on your prose and make it more compelling. And to be able to communicate your ideas quickly in 20 seconds on a television interview, I think actually can be very helpful then when you're structuring your classroom presence and interaction with students. I think it's kind of worked nicely. And certainly with my own writing, I do feel it's improved. And part of it is that work in the media.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm a big believer that, you know, academics, if they want, shouldn't separate themselves when these opportunities arise, because I think there's great things they can say. Again, even if you only have a sentence to say it or a few mm-hmm. seconds to say it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. No, but I you know, you should give yourself the proper amount of credit, because I've tried to do some of this myself, and I know lots of colleagues have. And I know in my case, I would say that there's nothing I can't say in there's nothing I can say in 50 words that I can't say in 5,000. So,
right.
so it is actually very difficult to boil it down in this way. And it's how would if you were giving advice to a historian that had something to say, what advice would you give? How do you approach editors, or how do you can you contact people at the local television station, or how does one? What are the mechanics of actually getting into sort of popular media?
In terms of writing op-eds, it's just a lot of patience. Most of the contacts are just online at this point, and there's a place to send op-eds. And in that type of effort, I think you just have to keep trying. I think you get a lot of rejections, I have, and you just keep plugging away, and then all of a sudden opportunities arise, something's accepted. Sometimes an editor will come back at you and say, I don't like this, but would you write something along mm-hmm. these lines? And you really have to be determined. And on the other stuff, to be honest, I don't know how it all happens. I mean, it starts in part when you're at a university. University usually has a public relations kind of outfit.
Mm-hmm.
And their job is to get the professors and the media. And I think if you want this, you have to be proactive and really tell them what you do. They don't always know kind of a historian is the natural go-to person. And talk with them, and they have lists of reporters in all the different media and can get your name out there pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And I think importantly, you start, if you want to do this, you shouldn't be too selective, meaning take a kind of local news channel as seriously as you take NPR or CNN news, whatever, and work on it. I mean, it took me a lot of time. Now I can do radio quickly. I can be called on the spot and do a 20-minute mm-hmm. interview. I'm not nervous. I think I know how to do it.
Mm-hmm.
But I did a lot of them, and I started with the local Albany NPR
mm-hmm.
or commercial radio. And I went on local TV. I'd wake up at 5:30 in the morning and go and talk with the news guys. And I remember when I did it, I said, well, I'll just keep doing it. And then, you know, eventually I'll get bigger opportunities, and I'll be ready to go on national TV if that came up. And it did. So it's like everything else. It's like writing, teaching, and everything else we do. Just you need to practice, and you need to use small opportunities to prepare yourself for bigger ones.
Mm-hmm. We should also mention the History News Service, which will help historians who write op-ed pieces distribute them. And the History News Service can be found on HNET. If you just Google History News Service, you will find it if you're a historian with an op-ed piece. And you would like to have the History News Service help you. I know that they've been helpful to many historians in the past. One thing I did want to ask is about popular books. One thing that I find kind of fascinating is that once historians get tenure, you know, and they sort of secure in their careers, they'll often continue to – well, first of all, they'll often stop writing altogether. But they'll often continue to write these rather obscure, although very valuable, monographs, and they won't go on to write popular books. This book of yours is published with a trade press, a very good trade press, not your usual trade press. Not that trade presses are bad for my friends in the trade press business. But how did you come to have the opportunity to write for a trade press?
Well, When I thought of the book proposal, I had just floated it around. I didn't have any agent or I didn't have anything like that. And a bunch of editors were interested. I had an offer from a couple trade presses. This book was signed with another press, in fact, and the editor then moved to a trade press and signed it or brought it over there. And now my next couple books are also with trade presses.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really just a matter, what's important, I think, is your proposal. Yeah. That was very important, to write a proposal in a different way than you might if you were going for many academic presses. And then, you know, the editors have to see this as something that can sell. I mean, it's a commercial operation.
Right, exactly.
Which increasingly is the case with university presses, to be honest, at this point. But my ambition was to write for more, a bigger audience.
Mm-hmm.
So this was attractive to me. Unlike some other disciplines, I think in history you can write almost the same kind of book, you know, just really improving your prose and cutting down some of the jargon, and it could be a trade book. I don't think the switch is as big as it might be for an economist or a political scientist. So for me, this was exciting. I feel like this is the book I would have written for an academic press in many ways, other than they pushed me on my writing to really bring out the story in ways I think all historians should do. But the proposal, the key, there are a lot of writers now, including myself, who have literary agents who you just have to approach also online with a book idea. And if they accept you, they can get the attention of trade editors in ways it's hard if you're just a historian setting these out, and they'll take a look at it. And I think that they also can work on you with you on how do you shape a proposal that a trade press will see as favorable and something they want to sign. And I think the agent, if this is the path you want to take, is really kind of crucial.
Yeah, no, I agree completely. I have an agent. His name's Bob Mikoy. If anybody wants to contact him, he's very disappointed in me because I've made him no money. But he's a very good guy and he's worked with me a lot, and he really has helped me shape. That's not exactly true. I did write a few things for him. He really did help me understand exactly what trade press editors want. And when you understand what trade press editors want, I think you have a better understanding of what the American public probably wants to read. That is a better understanding that you're likely to get in a graduate student seminar about, say, 16th century Russia. Where you'll get no impression at all about what America wants to read. So I think talking to both editors and to agents is probably a good idea. And I always encourage historians who, again, have written their monograph and gotten tenure in their articles and that kind of thing to think a little bit about how the story that they have told, the research that they have done, can help inform the popular debate about, well, just about everything. I mean, in your case, you're right. The connection is very close. People recognize the things in your book. But I wrote an article, this must be 10 years ago, that was published internationally, actually, about the importance of what had happened in 16th and 17th century Russia to what was happening in Russia today. I mean, and I didn't make it up. It's true. It did really matter, and I managed to get the attention of a few editors. Again, I got in Europe and both in the United States. But you're absolutely right about being a little bit thick-skinned about it. And academics don't tend to be terribly thick-skinned. I'll only speak for myself, I guess. But you get a lot of rejection. You know, you're going to get a big pile of people saying no. I mean, I used to say when I worked kind of as an editor that an editor's job is to say no. That's what they do for a living.
You have to have thick skin. You have to be willing to change and to listen to your both editors, to your agents. And if you're not willing to do that, it probably won't work. It's probably not what you want to do. But I think that's true. I'd say that's also true to go back to before to being a public intellectual. I mean, it's a tough world out there, especially with the internet. And you have to be willing, I think, both of you are going to write books that reach a broader audience or to make statements and write op-eds to take the response that comes with that.
Yeah, no, that's
right. And I could say it's very, I think the internet has changed. It wasn't until the internet like this. But you're easily accessible now, and it can get pretty nasty. And in the end, that, you know, can't, for some people, I think that is a deterrent, legitimately. But you have to have a thick skin. You have to be willing to have people say, if you're a public intellectual, bad things about you. And when you're trying to sell a trade book, you have to be willing to hear no, and you really need to improve or change your style a bit. I think those are things to consider before you go down that path.
No, I think that's exactly right. A certain amount of soul searching is necessary. I remember when I first became involved in, let's call it, a debate on the internet using kind of historical arguments. And pretty much anybody can participate, and you get responses which are a little bit rougher than you might, again, get in that graduate seminar. And you have to become used to that. You know, you're going to be called an idiot and a lot worse. You know, things that your mother would wash her mouth out with soap.
Right.
About. Just, you just have to get used to that. And it's disturbing. I mean, I have to admit, I found it very disturbing at first to be called every name in the book an idiot and everything like this. But, you know, that's part of public discourse. And if
the payoff is that you can, you know, throw your ideas out to a readership that is just much bigger than you'll ever be able to do. And that can be very rewarding. So, there's trade-offs.
Let me talk we're in the closing minutes of the interview. We've taken up a heck of a lot of your time, but I want to ask just a couple more questions. And one is about the internet itself. Do you do anything on the internet? I mean, do you have a blog, or do you participate in a group blog, or do you read historical or political blogs?
Not that much, to be honest. I mean, I do write for places like Politico, which are solely online at this point. I mean, online news is the wave of the future. And I do write for that. I've written for the Huffington Post, but I don't blog. I've never done that. I'm out of time. I like when I have something to say, basically, at this point, when I have a response to something in the news, I do want to save it for one of my columns, rather than just blogging it. I read any history? I read mostly news blogs, basically. News is really what I consume through the internet. My writing and my news reading does come, you know, entirely from the internet at this point.
Yeah. No, I you know, this show is part of an effort on my part. When I was in journalism, when I worked for this magazine in Washington, I became aware of the fact that the internet was really the best way to distribute this kind of thing, but there wasn't really a space at that time. This was a long time ago, for serious debate. And I think there is now. And you mentioned Politico and these other places. They're very serious, and they're done by fair-minded, intelligent people, and you can feel safe there. There's a community blog that I participate in quite a bit called Metafilter, and I can tell you that they're very serious people. There are 60,000 of them who are participants on this discussion site, and they're very, very smart people. They're kind of self-selected. So there is a safe space. It's not all naked ladies and whatever else they have. There is a place for it. And again, this show is part of an effort to expand that space in a certain way. And, you know, that's my own little contribution. But I would encourage anybody who is interested in these things to go to something like the History News Network, or go to the History News Service if you have an op-ed that you'd like printed somewhere, and kind of, attempt to get out there and say what historians can say.
Yeah, I did use the History News Service a few years ago, I remember, for a couple pieces, and they were terrific. I mean, they were really, really, you got editing, very good editing before you sent this out, and the stories are picked up by newspapers that pay for the service. And it's really, I think it's a great thing for historians that they're doing. And people should take advantage of it.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And, you know, there's just a whole bunch of really good history blogs out there. I mentioned the History News Service, but and the History News Network, but there are lots of them out there that you can read if you're interested. And, I really encourage historians to get involved in this kind of thing because, you know, what are we? But I always tell my students and their parents when they come to meet me that I'm an employee of this the state of Iowa. I serve the people of Iowa. That's what I do. So I'm very excited about these new methods of distribution. I think that they're extraordinarily important and can only add to the kind of richness of our public debate. As I said, we've taken up, Julian, an absolutely huge amount of your time. I find all this very fascinating. And I'd like to conclude the interview with our traditional final question on New Books in History. That is, what is your next project? You mentioned you have a couple irons in the fire.
Yes, I have three books that will be coming out over next year. I have one on the presidency of Jimmy Carter, which will be with Times Books. A second edited book on the presidency of George W. Bush with a group of terrific historians writing about different issues, placing him in context. And I co-wrote a book with Professor Meg Jacobs of MIT on the Reagan Revolution, which is with Bedford for undergraduate, and that'll be coming out next year. Mm-hmm. A bunch of articles I've written that are coming out, including one on kind of looking again at the history of conservatism and new trends that are coming out. And finally, I'm just starting a new book as I finish these others on the Great Society.
Wow.
So those are the projects in process.
Well, then you'll have to be on the show multiple times. That's the deal. If you're on once, you get to be on many times. I would like to thank you again. Julian Zelizer has been on the show today, and we've been talking about his terrific new book, Arsenal of Democracy, The Politics of National Security, from World War II to the War on Terrorism. And again, I just want to thank you, Julian, for being on the show.
Thanks so much.
All right, take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to an interview with Julian Zelizer about his new book, Arsenal of Democracy, The Politics of National Security from World War II to the War on Terrorism. I'm Marshall Poe, the host of New Books in History. I hope you have a great week.